I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection. It is, what is it? I'm looking at Monday's agenda. It's Wednesday, January 21st. We're going to have an informational meeting today, kind of an overview from the different agencies and that deal with consumer protection issues. I wouldn't say that this list is all inclusive, but surely some of the major industries that deal with consumer protection issues are will be presenting today. So I felt that this was a pretty important overview for the members who haven't served on this committee, essentially because there's a lot of different agencies that deal with a vast array of different industries and issues that affect consumers. So I'm not going to delay too much longer with that, and would like to bring up first the Department of Justice with Drew Leonopoulos, please, and company.
Chair Hulvey, members of the committee, good afternoon. Copies of my written testimony I'll pass out. With me is Keith Dubanovich, special counsel to the Attorney General on consumer protection issues.
If you could give them to the committee assistant, Drew, that would help.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And you, either one of you, may begin when you want.
Thank you, Chair Hulvey. Chair Hulvey, members of the committee, again, my name is Drew Leonopoulos. Good afternoon. My official title is Attorney in Charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section at the Oregon Department of Justice. Basically, that means I'm the head of the Attorney General's Consumer Protection Unit. I've provided you written copies of my testimony concerning the operation of our section. I'd like to give you a quick preview of what I hope to cover at this meeting before going into more details in those areas. First, I'd like to give you an overview of what our section does. Next, I'll describe our consumer complaint process and discuss some of the recent consumer complaint statistics we've compiled for 2008. Then I'll discuss some of our prevention efforts, move on to some of our enforcement efforts with an emphasis on how we enforce the state's main consumer protection law, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, or the UTPA. I'll quickly outline some personnel and funding matters and end with a brief description of the pre-session file bills that we have for 2009. So first, the overview. Our section is part of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. That means that we are a civil, not a criminal, enforcement authority. Our goal is to foster competition in a free and fair marketplace by educating consumers and businesses and by invoking the Attorney General's civil enforcement authority to deter, stop, and punish unlawful conduct. We enforce the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which is Oregon's main consumer protection statute. And I'll go into a fair amount of detail into that statute later on in my testimony. Our newly elected Attorney General, John Kroger, intends to prioritize consumer protection of Oregonians under his administration, and he's hired an attorney to serve as special counsel in his front office to ensure that his consumer protection agenda is faithfully and aggressively implemented. And that special counsel is here with me today, Keith Dubanovich. I set forth our mission statement in the bottom of page one in my written testimony. Next, I'd like to just briefly describe our consumer complaint process with you because it's an important component of our program. Consumer complaints come into us through a variety of sources. They come into us electronically through our website, through our regular mail. We take walk-ins at our office, which is located in South Salem, and we operate a toll-free telephone hotline where consumers can call and ask questions. We can direct them to various sources of information, tell them if we have open investigations on certain companies and encourage them to file with us written inquiries or complaints if they're having a problem with a company. That consumer complaint hotline is staffed by volunteers and closely supervised by a volunteer coordinator. When we get written complaints, they are from consumers. They're evaluated by an intake unit and assigned to one of several enforcement officers. The enforcement officer's role is twofold. Basically, to try to resolve the consumer's complaint satisfactorily and to look and see if there are a pattern and practice of complaints that are present. If there are a pattern and practice, if there's a pattern and practice detected, then the enforcement officer basically elevates the complaint for further review to myself and our chief investigator, and we decide then whether a formal enforcement action should be initiated or not. The case assignment process takes place on at least a weekly basis, and the three people in the room who make those decisions have between us about 60 years of consumer protection experience. Typically, again, one of the other role that the enforcement officers play are to try to resolve the consumer's complaints, and that may or may not result in a refund to consumers. Typically, we generate several million dollars of refunds a year for consumers. Last year, 2008, we generated approximately $3 million in refunds through our complaint system. Last year, the telephone volunteers handled approximately 31,500 calls. That was up from just slightly over 31,000 calls in 2007. In that same period, 2008, we received approximately 12,600 written contacts or complaints. And we count any written correspondence to us about a company as a complaint. Sometimes they just come in as a FYI, thought you might want to know about this, or something like that. So that gets counted in our statistics as a complaint. And again, the 12,000, more than 12,500, that was up from a little over 11,000 in 2007. In 2008, we opened approximately 240 formal investigations through the case assignment process, and that was up from approximately 180 formal investigations in 2007. So who are consumers contacting us about last year? It was about the same. The top five was about the same as it was in 2007. Telecommunications leads the way. That's a very broad category in our complaint database. We count cable, satellites, cell phone, landlines, internet service providers as telecommunications providers. Financial institutions were a close second. Credit cards, mortgage brokers, commercial banks, international money transfer schemes were third. Those are basically Nigerian scams, although they can come from any country, but Nigeria's particularly noteworthy. Collection agencies were our fourth. Motor vehicle sales rounded out the top five. Okay, moving on to prevention efforts. We really believe that an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure, and we've published and distribute a wide variety of consumer protection, consumer educational materials. Topics include diverse matters such as how to prevent identity theft, to hearing aid issues. We have a consumer information coordinator, Jan Margosian, who regularly speaks around the state at many events and distributes a wide variety of consumer education materials that we have. Those are printed in several different languages. Everything we have is printed in Spanish as well as English, and we have most of our materials in several other languages as well, most of our educational materials. We work cooperatively with businesses and trade associations representing various different industries, ranging from automobile dealers to telecom providers. We work with them to help identify issues and iron out potential problems before they get out of hand and before they require our formal enforcement action. We found that most businesses in the state are straightforward and honest and want to do the right thing, and they really appreciate those that cooperative relationship. When businesses are not so straightforward and not so honest, then we find that the enforcement avenue is clearly the route to take, and we don't hesitate to take that. We coordinate our actions with other attorneys general's offices and agencies in the state and federal agencies as well. We work multi-state actions, so actions done in coordination with other states' consumer protection counterparts. We leverage the power of each of our attorneys general's offices that way. The tobacco litigation that was it's now more than 10 years old is a very good example of how powerful a state attorneys general can be when working in a coordinated fashion that way. We are now recognized as a national leader in taking a lead role in coordinated multi-state actions against pharmaceutical companies who have deceptively marketed prescription drugs. We are now routinely taking the lead with states such as California, New York, Illinois, Florida, states that have much larger consumer protection sections than we do, but we've established a very high profile in that area and established a very good leadership role nationally in that area. We have several interagency agreements within the state, one with the Public Utilities Commission to help us evaluate complaints on cellular telephone providers, for instance, that we have that we've reached enforcement agreements with, assurances of voluntary compliance with. We likewise have an interagency agreement with the Construction Contractors Board where they refer matters to us and we take action against unlicensed or fraudulent contractors. We place a special emphasis on coordinating our work with agencies or organizations that have expertise in working with vulnerable populations like seniors, DHS, for instance. We've formed a partnership with the Willamette Legal Clinic, we work cooperatively with them to make sure that scams that target Latinos or consumers whose first language is not English are worked vigorously and appropriately when we might not have the resources within our own section to do that independently. I want to move now to some of our enforcement actions and our the discussion of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. First, again, I want to emphasize that we are a civil law enforcement agency. We're not a regulatory agency. We don't issue, revoke, or suspend business or regulatory licenses. The businesses we oversee don't pay any regulatory or licensing fees to us, with a minor exception of telemarketers, and we just instituted that particular license so we could be sure to review their scripts in advance of them being allowed to operate in this state. Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practice Act, which is the main law that our section enforces, is a series of a laundry list of prohibited practices. They range from both general prohibitions, such as causes likelihood of confusion or misunderstanding as to source, sponsorship, or certification of real estate goods or services, as well as specific prohibitions like a prohibition against manufacturing a mercury thermometer. There are both private and public actions that can be brought to bear against someone who commits a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. In theory, district attorneys also have the authority to bring UTPA actions, but in reality, the last district attorney program in this state was consumer protection program under the UTPA was phased out about 20 years ago, so the Attorney General is the only government enforcer of the Unlawful Trade Practice Act now. Most actions in the course of a business, vocation, or occupation are covered under the Unlawful Trade Practice Act, including those of professionals like dentists, doctors, real estate agents, certified public accountants. However, there are some exclusions to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Loans and the extension of credit have been specifically excluded from that act. Insurance and certain landlord-tenant provisions have been excluded from the act. But the majority of consumer transactions conducted in the state fall under the jurisdiction of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Business-to-business transactions do not come under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The touchstone for us is covered by the Unlawful Trade Practices Act is found in the definition of real estate goods or services. That definition is real estate goods or services which are or may be obtained primarily for personal, household, or family purposes. The UTPA provides our office with diverse and effective investigative enforcement provisions. For instance, we can issue a civil investigative demand even when there's a suspected violation of a consumer protection law. Courts have liberally interpreted that provision to give the Attorney General the power to investigate anything that he thinks may be a potential violation. And there are significant penalties for or potential penalties for not complying with an Attorney General's investigation. A business simply does not have the option, if properly served with an investigative demand, to say, we don't think there's anything here, we just decline to play along here. Should a business do something like that, some do, we can go into court and ask that the business be enjoined from conducting any further business until they comply with our investigative subpoena. So it's a fairly a strong lever, and it's very rare that legitimate businesses refuse to cooperate with us. In fact, 99 times out of 100, the most useful provision of that civil investigative demand law happens when we are investigating a fly-by-night scam artist who has no intention of answering any questions to our office, and it's the easiest way to get a court order stopping that person or business from doing anything, any further business in the state, until they comply with our with our investigation. Several states have as their consumer protection laws basically a model that says sue first and ask questions later. Oregon, when it adopted the Unlawful Trade Practice Act, chose very wisely, I think, not to adopt that approach. Before the Attorney General can file a lawsuit against the business, unless there is a threat of an immediate harm to public safety, welfare, or health, except in that circumstance, we have to serve a business with a notice and give them 10 days to tender what's called an assurance of voluntary compliance, or an AVC, basically saying how they're going to remedy the problem, what they're going to do take care of our concern, including paying refunds to consumers. So businesses always have the opportunity to settle a matter that way before they're actually hauled into court by the Attorney General. Again, unless there is an immediate harm to public health, safety, or welfare. I'd like to turn now to some examples of recent enforcement actions that we've taken in 2009. I already mentioned the leading role that we find ourselves in multi-state actions against pharmaceutical companies who have deceptively marketed their prescription drugs. Some examples of companies that we've entered into settlements with in 2008, and again, these are national settlements that we have led, Pfizer, Eli Lilly, and Merck. We are currently engaged in litigation with LA Weight Loss for misrepresentations about its weight loss program and products.
Mr. Chair, would you entertain a question?
Certainly.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Can you tell us a little bit more about the pharmaceutical deceptively marketing prescription drugs?
Chair Hovey, Representative Tomey, yes. There are several different theories that several different problematic practices that were involved that these companies were engaged in. For instance, our investigations revealed that they have done research that they either failed to acknowledge that they did to the FTC to the FDA, or more importantly, misstated the results of that research when they promoted their products. They engaged in off-label marketing to physicians about the drugs, what they what they can be advertised to do, and what they can't. A variety of misrepresentations that were made along those lines.
Thank you so much. Mr. Chair, follow up?
Representative Tomey.
I would like to get together with you and find out exactly what that was and when these were and what were the products, et cetera, if there's a history of that.
Sure.
That would be great.
Chair Hovey, Representative Tomey, would be very happy to do that. A lot of information on these cases.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
You bet. And while you're stopped, I guess I might as well ask a question, too, in hopes that we can keep this moving along. But I did have one. You mentioned that you license or take fees from telemarketers. And so I've been getting these repeated calls from warrantyhelpdesk.com. No, are they licensed with you? Or do you regulate them? Because they asked me a whole series of questions, and I kept trying to find out who they were working for and what their phone number was and all of that. And eventually they said, we're going to connect you with one of our representatives. They hung up on me, and I called the number back, and of course it was not a good number. I guess it's only set up to call out on. You can't call in on it.
Chair Hovey, good question. I know that there are several companies with the name Warranty in them that we've had some real problems with.
Well, they call my state line, too, which you think would, you know, really not be too smart to call something that says you've reached State Representative Paul Holby and, you know.
Chair of Consumer Protection.
Yeah. So, anyway, I'll let you go on. I just, you know, maybe I'd lodge my own complaint against this order. They're from California, though.
Okay. Chair Holby, I'll follow up with you on that. And again, we have a pretty extensive database on companies, and I've
hung up with them several times.
And well, they're just annoying me. Yes?
Chair Holby, I think it could be an inside job just for your information.
I don't know how to take that. Anyway, go ahead and continue, please.
Yes.
And we're going to try to pick up the pace a little bit here so I can get to some of my other presenters, too, so I appreciate that.
Thank you, I will. We obtained a judgment against a Texas pharmacy that was unlicensed in Oregon that sold mislabeled prescription medications in the state. That led to the death of two Oregonians. We prohibited them from doing any further business in the state until they were appropriately licensed. Again, these are just examples of our consumer protection actions. We've shut down internet retailers like Tono Records. This was a California-based company that deceptively marketed and mailed supposedly free English tapes to Spanish-speaking consumers in the state, and then turned around and charged them hundreds of dollars in shipping and handling costs for these quote-unquote free tapes. Again, we've filed a number of lawsuits and obtained judgments against many unlicensed construction contractors, and we ensure that automobile dealers comply with applicable advertising laws and regulations. Next, funding and personnel. Up until 2003, our section was funded through two sources, general funds, typically around a third of our budget, and the other two-thirds was typically came from enforcement actions that we take against businesses. Since 2003, we have not had any general funding, so we have been entirely self-funded through our enforcement actions, and we project that this is sustainable through this biennium, but probably not indefinitely. Our section is comprised of 9 assistant attorney generals, 6 investigators, 5 enforcement officers, 4 paralegals, and 9 support staff. The governor's recommended budget for 2009-11 includes a policy option package that adds 8 full-time employees to the section for enhanced consumer protection activities. And we have 4 consumer protection proposals, bills, pre-session file, Senate Bill 328 in the Consumer Protection and Public Affairs Committee. That provides that a person who engages in an unlawful debt collection practice would also violate the Unlawful Trade Practice Act. House Bill 2267 in the Judiciary Committee is a technical revision of our civil investigative demand statute. House Bill 2268 in this committee would require that automobile vehicle repair shops provide a cost estimate to consumers before performing work on a vehicle. And House Bill 2270, also in this committee, would require that a seller of consumer goods disclose shipping and handling costs at the time that the solicitation was made. With that, and with the Chair's admonishment on time, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
If the Chair would allow, I'd like to provide a few closing comments. My name is Keith Dubanovich, and I was recently appointed by Attorney General Kroger to be special counsel. And one of my primary tasks is indeed to work with your committee and with Mr. Leonopoulos' group in the consumer protection area. Unfortunately, with our downturn in the economy, we anticipate an increase in consumer concerns and probably an increase in the number of cases that we'll be handling under the UTPA. We do eagerly look forward to working with you, and we'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming forward and introducing yourself as well. So I as well look forward to any dialogue that we can have to do something about protecting consumers, because I agree, in these times you see, you know, many other kinds of scams and frauds pop up that we didn't see yesterday. Just for my own, for the record and for my own knowledge, could you spell your name for
me,
please?
D-U-B-A-N-E, as in Edward, V as in Victor, I-C-H, Dubanovich.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And welcome, and appreciate your testimony, Mr. Leonopoulos and Mr. Dubanovich, for coming along and your closing comments. I'm sure we'll hear from you again in this committee.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hovey.
And I'll get back to you on this warranty help desk thing. Next up, I'd like to have Corey Streisinger from the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
And Chair, I'd like to have Mr. Tapman join me if I could.
And Mr. David Tapman.
Thank you.
Welcome. Chair. Good afternoon.
Pleasure to be back here. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is David Tapman, Administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and we may at some point during the committee be joined by Teresa Miller, who is Acting Administrator of our Insurance Division. Those are the two programs that are most likely to be before this committee. I wanted to just briefly outline what we do as a department and then focus in on the areas that most closely involve consumer protection. And we are the state's largest business regulatory and consumer protection agency. Our role is a little different than the consumer protection section of the Department of Justice. We are a regulatory agency. We license, we establish regulatory standards, and we do enforcement. And in those program areas specifically that have been assigned to us by the legislature, we do not have the broad-based general consumer protection authority that applies across the spectrum. I will say, because the name of our agency is the Department of Consumer and Business Services, we tend to get a lot of calls on a wide variety of consumer issues. We work closely with the Department of Justice, sending issues to them that are within their jurisdiction, as they do with us on the lending and insurance issues that are within our jurisdiction. We've provided you with a packet of materials which you should have in front of you, as well as my written testimony, and I'll be referring to some of those materials as we go through. Our mission as an agency is to protect and serve Oregon's consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. And I will say, in our view, those two parts of the mission go together. Protection of consumers and workers and good standards and solid, consistent enforcement also supports a good industry in the areas that we regulate. It's a level playing field, it's clear standards that everyone's able to comply with, and it's protection of consumers and workers who depend on those services. Our major programs are workers' compensation, Oregon OSHA, building codes, insurance, finance, and corporate securities. And you will see in your packet a general overview of our department, some of our accomplishments over the past couple of years, as well as our action plans for the next couple of years, and we've provided you with contact information for the department as well. I'm not going to touch in great detail on OSHA and workers' compensation, since those aren't within this committee's jurisdiction, but generally speaking, Oregon OSHA is our state worker safety program. We operate under federal standards, but we do the enforcement. We set our own rules and standards. We consult with businesses here at the state level. In workers' compensation, our goals are to ensure that employers provide compensation to their workers in the case of injury, that workers receive timely and accurate benefits, and that they get back to work promptly. And Oregon's workers' compensation system actually has a national record of 19 years of flat or declining workers' compensation rates, declining injury rates, and success in return to work. We have just announced, we have just implemented our third straight year of declines. There's a 5.9% decline in workers' compensation rates for 2009, and in this business climate, anything we can do to help businesses get workers back to work is a benefit to us. As an agency, we have some overall principles that we try to use in carrying out our mission. We try to focus on areas where there are real concerns that our citizens are experiencing, rather than simply working on process that isn't a result of real consumer concerns or worker concerns that we've heard. We use a wide variety of approaches: education, training, consultation, and outreach, as well as regulation and enforcement. We tend to work in collaborative work groups to try to find solutions that achieve our goals of consumer protection while also working for the industry that we regulate. We try to minimize the regulatory burden on businesses, but consistent with the consumer and worker protection outcomes that we're trying to achieve. We try to make it easier to do business with us, easier to find information from us through good use of technology, and we try to collect good data on our programs so that we can measure what our outcomes really are. I want to spend most of my time today talking about our financial regulatory programs that have the biggest consumer protection impact, but before I do that, I do want to mention building codes very briefly, because there are consumer protection issues associated with building codes as well, and last session this committee spent quite some time dealing with an issue that actually involves insurance as well as building codes, and that is the issue of construction defects and how do we make sure that construction meets quality standards. There was a lot of time spent in this committee, legislation passed, and also a number of recommendations that we were able to implement administratively, and one of the items in your packet is a summary of some of our administrative work, and the major focus of which was to reduce moisture content in construction, because that tends to be a major source of construction defects. In building codes, we're also focused heavily on electronic permitting to make it easier for the construction industry to move quickly and save time and costs, as well as a focus on green building, energy efficiency, and sustainability issues at the moment. So moving to our financial programs, I do want to turn to, first of all, insurance. And I should say, overall, we regulate insurance, and then a cluster in the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which Mr. Tapman heads.
Corey, if you might, we could have Teresa Miller come up now, if you'd like.
Teresa Miller has entered the room.
All right.
I wasn't going to let her sit back there and get off the hook.
Ms. Miller joined us in about 7 or 8 months ago as the acting administrator of our insurance division. And in fact, I'm about to start with insurance, so your timing is excellent. We monitor insurance companies' financial condition to ensure that they'll be able to pay claims. We enforce insurance laws aimed at fair treatment of the insurance buying public. We review some types of insurance rates and policy language before those insurance policies can be sold. And we provide consumer education and work with consumers to resolve insurance rate-related problems. Insurance is almost entirely state-regulated. It's unique among the major financial institutions that way. There is no separate federal agency oversight of insurance in most areas. But state insurance regulators collaborate through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and there are, therefore, national standards and a great deal of reciprocity. For example, if a state insurance regulatory body meets accreditation standards set by the NAIC, as Oregon does, financial examinations performed here will be accepted by other participating states. So that adds to efficiency and allows insurance companies to work nationally without being re-regulated and subject to different standards. And I would point out that whether insurance should continue to be regulated primarily at the state level is a subject of great national debate at the moment, in part arising from some of the major economic challenges that we're facing at the national level. And it is very interesting to note that one of the entities that's received the most attention because of its financial difficulties and a great deal of federal financial support as well is AIG. But the entity that experienced the financial difficulties is the holding company, which is not an insurance company and is not state regulated. The insurance subsidiaries of AIG, which are state regulated, are completely solvent. So state solvency regulation has actually been effective in this area. But because of the economic climate that we're experiencing, we have needed to step up our oversight of insurance finances. And we actually have a legislative proposal which we will be bringing forward in that area. Oregon currently does not limit the amount of an insurance company's assets that can be invested in common stock. And what that means when we experience a severe downturn in the stock market, as we have just done, is that insurance companies may need to take steps very suddenly and they're to preserve their financial situation. And, in fact, in some cases, their financial situation may be at risk. So we will have a proposal, which is similar to laws in place in several other states, to limit the amount that an insurer can invest in common stocks to make sure that they maintain the financial resources necessary to meet their obligations to claimants and policyholders. Some other areas we're dealing with in insurance right now. A major priority for all of us is access to high-quality, affordable health care. This has been a focus for DCBS through our oversight of health insurance. We have participated and continue to participate in the Oregon Health Fund Board process, and we look forward to working with the House Committee on Health Care to achieve the broad reform goals set out by the Oregon Health Fund Board. One of our major initiatives in this area has been increased transparency, getting better information to consumers and policymakers about the cost of health care and how to make good health care choices. We have established a website in cooperation with the Office of Health Policy and Research that allows consumers to compare hospital prices by hospital and by procedure so that you can tell if you have a choice. Your doctor says, I have privileges at these two hospitals. You can make a choice about where to go for your hip replacement, for example. Quality information is also available through the Office of Health Policy and Research, but price information is important to many people as well, as the amount of cost share that individuals often have to bear has gone up. We, on that issue, we're also working currently with health insurers on implementation of last session's House Bill 2213, which some of you will probably remember. That bill will allow anyone covered by health insurance to find out in advance what their own share of the cost of a medical procedure will be, that is, their deductible, their co-pays, so that, once again, if there are options available to that consumer, they can take price into their own price into account in making those choices. That bill, the effective date is this July, and so we're rapidly approaching the time when that information will be available. Also, as a result of last session's House Bill 3103, insurance company health insurance rate filings with us are now public. And health insurance rates, of course, have increased very substantially over the past few years, and we are working to improve our internal process for rate review. We will also have some legislation to suggest about how to improve that process, which we look forward to discussing with you in more detail if those bills do end up in this committee. One of those proposals, again, is one that some of you may remember from last session. We believe that it would be more appropriate to lay out in statutes what the factors are that can be taken into account in reviewing health insurance rates and to make explicit that issues like insurer profits, surplus, and investment income can be taken into account. So that should be coming forward shortly. In addition to our regulation of health insurance, we also have two other health insurance-related programs. One of them is the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is the high-risk pool that provides coverage to people who have health conditions that mean that they've been turned down for coverage in the private market. So if someone doesn't qualify for group insurance and they have a heart condition or they have cancer or they have AIDS and they can't get individual insurance, they can actually get insurance through the state of Oregon, through the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. We also have the Senior Health Insurance Benefits Assistance Program, or SHIBA, which works with a volunteer network to provide information to seniors about their health insurance options. We have a brochure about the SHIBA program in our folder, and if any of you have constituents who are trying to work their way through the complexities of Medicare Part D, for example, I would strongly recommend that they contact a SHIBA volunteer, because those are very complex programs and help is available. I mentioned earlier that part of our insurance oversight includes consumer advocacy. We help thousands of Oregonians every year with insurance-related problems, and we answer questions, but we also advocate for them with insurance companies and investigate complaints or concerns people are having. This consumer advocacy work also helps us identify long-term problems and trends. If we get a cluster, if we get a single complaint, we work with the consumer on that complaint. If we get a cluster of complaints about the same issue, we work with those consumers, but we also look for an underlying problem. Sometimes it's a problem with an individual health insurance carrier that could lead to enforcement action. Sometimes it's a problem with our laws or regulations, and then that can lead to proposals for change. And several bills in the past few sessions have come out of that process. One of them is the new protections for homeowners insurance, some of you may recall. The bill that I just mentioned that will give consumers access to information ahead of time about the cost of medical procedures, that also was a suggestion that came out of that consumer advocacy group, because we got so many concerns and complaints in that area. This session, we also have a bill that's come out of our consumer complaint process, and it deals with auto insurance and the process of calculating total loss. This is consistently one of the areas where we get the most complaints. A consumer hears from the insurance company that their car is totaled. That is, that the value of the car isn't sufficient to make repair worthwhile, and here's the amount that we're going to pay you for your totaled car. The process is often a mystery to consumers, and we think the process can be improved, not only to give consumers better understanding of how that amount is determined, but also to provide some protection for a consumer who may find themselves in a situation where they have no car, they need a check, and they may feel coerced into an early settlement when it isn't in their best interest. So again, we will have House Bill 2190, which we think is likely to be before this committee as well. Key aspect of consumer protection is helping consumers understand how to evaluate their financial options, and this is a focus for us in insurance and also in our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And I should mention, we also work collaboratively with the Department of Justice in this area. We hand out their brochures. They hand out our brochures. We have, I think, at various times shared table space at the Oregon State Fair, and it's a good way to get information out to consumers. Some of our information, examples of our brochures, are also in our packet. And one area we have been focusing on quite a bit recently, and I actually heard the same focus area from Drew Leonopoulos, is seniors. And seniors in particular tend to be vulnerable in their financial dealings because they rely on their assets as their source of income rather than a wage. And so often a senior will have a certain amount of money which they need to have invested in a way that will supply an income. And the unfortunate case is that where there is money, there is sometimes also either misleading information or unsuitable products or fraud. So we have been emphasizing assistance to seniors and enforcement in this area. There's a whole packet of brochures that we've given you some samples of that are aimed at helping seniors understand their choices. We've been doing outreach at senior organizations. We've also put in place several years ago new rules prohibiting the sale of unsuitable life insurance and annuity products to seniors. We have suitability standards in the securities and investment area as well. And as I mentioned, this has also been an enforcement focus for us. We recently took a major enforcement action against a life insurance company, Bankers Life, based on the sale of unsuitable annuity products to seniors. That resulted in not only a substantial fine, a number of seniors getting their funds refunded. There's a review of additional files to see whether additional refunds are needed, and also a significant change in the practices for reviewing suitability. Another area that is of concern to us with respect to seniors is the increasing use of misleading titles and designations, such as certified senior specialist or other tools used by salespeople in their marketing pitches that are aimed at making the senior believe that the person they're speaking to is not a salesperson, but rather some type of independent professional advisor. And we are looking at rulemaking to put limits on the use of that type of technique. Some of these, as I mentioned, are issues that involve both insurance and our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, because some of these products overlap. For example, variable annuities are marketed, are actually regulated both as insurance and financial security products. I'd like, though, to turn away from insurance and talk a little about the programs that we regulate in our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And those include state chartered depository institutions, banks, and credit unions, enforcement of the state securities laws. We regulate mortgage lenders, consumer finance lenders, payday lenders, title lenders, pawnbrokers, pre-need funeral trusts, money transmitters, check cashers, collection agencies. As you can see, it's a wide range of programs that involve consumers and their financial affairs. And we use a fairly consistent set of tools in those areas. We do financial examinations to investigate not only an entity's financial background but also its practices. We use consumer outreach and education. We use rulemaking. We use enforcement. Mortgage lending has been a focus, as I'm sure you all know, of very considerable attention for us over the past few years. It's been a focus for this committee as well. We will be presenting an overview of mortgage lending issues, I believe, on Monday. So I'm not actually going to touch on mortgage lending today. I will save that for our presentation on Monday. Our overall goal in this area is to encourage a variety of financial options for Oregonians, but also to ensure that financial services are, and products are safe, sound, and fraud-free. Similar to our insurance functions, then, we use that range of tools to ensure that we meet that standard. We, in many of these areas, however, unlike insurance, we share regulatory responsibility with the federal government. For example, securities are regulated both at the state and federal level. And banks and credit unions, a bank or credit union can choose whether to have a federal charter or a state charter. And federal law preempts us from regulating federally chartered institutions in most areas. And that does present some challenges for us, which you may well hear about as in the months to come, in terms of making sure that we have good state-level regulation, but also making sure that we have consistency and a level playing field. We have seen increasing interest in federal regulation in this area, as well as insurance. We believe state-level regulation can make sure that we're responsive to concerns and problems that we're seeing here at the state level, but we do support appropriate federal regulation as well. Our general pitch to our congressional delegation when we talk about these issues is that we don't believe federal legislation should preempt state legislation when stronger standards are needed at the state level. And you'll be hearing more about this from us as well. We believe we should have state-level enforcement ability when the feds set standards, because we often have the ability to respond to complaints more effectively here at the state level. I mentioned earlier the impact of the economic downturn and the financial crisis on the insurance industry, and as you are no doubt aware, the impact has been significant in the financial services sector as well. Last September, the Emergency Board authorized us to increase our bank examination staff, and we also expect to add examination staff in the credit union area. This has enabled us to increase the frequency as well as the complexity of our financial examinations, and we continue to work with our state-chartered institutions to weather this economic downturn. And we have also stepped up our response to Oregonians about their concerns about the stability of their insurance, their bank accounts, their investments. We do have a website entitled Is My Money Safe? We gave you a snapshot of the web page in your folder, and we've attempted on that website to collect a variety of information that's useful to people who want to know what, for example, that their bank accounts are insured by the FDIC, and that limit is now $250,000, that their investments with a securities broker are safe, and so on. And if you've got constituents who have concerns in those areas, we would encourage you to look at that website as well, and of course we're also happy to respond to those concerns. The economic downturn has created new areas of concern. You've heard some of those from Mr. Leonopoulos. One of the areas that we're currently focused on is the proliferation of entities who offer consumers, or who say that they offer consumers, help in dealing with their debt. And some of these entities are very legitimate and provide very important services, the nonprofit consumer credit counseling organizations. But unfortunately, there are also those who are less legitimate, less helpful, and sometimes, in fact, harmful. And one of our proposals, which you'll see in House Bill 2192, would be to bring those under an umbrella that sets consistent standards and requires licensure by all debt management organizations. We currently license only some portions of the industry. We have actually two different regulatory programs. They're somewhat overlapping and also leave gaps, so we're proposing replacing that. I mentioned that we do regulate collection agencies. Our regulation is focused on the relationship between the collection agency and its customer, that is, the creditor. We do not engage directly in the regulation of debt collection practices. You've heard from Mr. Leonopoulos that the Department of Justice is bringing forward a proposal in that area, and we do believe that additional oversight is useful and appropriate, particularly as more and more consumers are going to be struggling with debt. Last session, as you probably know, was an active time for consumer protection. We have implemented a number of the bills that you passed last time. Oregon's new ID theft law is now in effect. We worked very closely with to educate the business community about their obligations to enforce those or to implement new standards for protecting personal identifiable information for their employees and customers. And we worked with consumers to educate consumers about their rights under the new law. And you'll see some of our materials in your packet. There's one brochure aimed at businesses and one for consumers. I should say our role is not dealing with the consequences of when an identity theft takes place. Rather, our role is to ensure that businesses do their part to prevent identity theft by safeguarding critical information. We have implemented the 2007 legislation capping fees that can be charged by check cashers, and as well as the interest rate caps on consumer finance and payday lenders, which, as I think you probably know, has had a significant impact on reducing the amount of payday lending in Oregon. Before I close, I'd like to briefly mention our enforcement activities in this area. And it is unfortunately the case that in the world of investments and the world of financial activities, we do need to have the ability to do strong enforcement. Last year overall, we completed 121 investigations in our financial programs, and that's not including insurance, resulting in 92 enforcement actions, cease and desist orders, fines, penalties, license suspensions, revocations, and also 14 criminal prosecutions. We do work with other law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, the SEC, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Department of Justice, county district attorneys, and we do get involved in some of the particularly investment fraud schemes that that victimize Oregonians, some other types of enforcement actions, for example, debt collection agency that collected money but did not pass it on to the creditor, and quite a few cases involving mortgage fraud, which, again, we'll talk about more on Monday. So we do look forward to discussing this wide range of issues with you further as the session progresses. This has been a very high-level, I know, sort of 60,000-foot overview of what we do. We're happy to answer any questions either now or at a later time about these programs.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of appreciated, Corey, some of the things I've heard today. I did notice, though, that when you mentioned vulnerable seniors, I swear you looked at me every time.
Pure coincidence.
Is that what it was? One question. Not only I have experienced, and some of my constituents have experienced, I guess it's the policy of some drug companies or insurance companies, they only allow a 30-day prescription for drugs that you're going to need for 2, 3, 4 years, or maybe the rest of your life. Now, is that a policy, or can that be, because what ends happening is you pay a copay every 30 days. Now, right now, I haven't had high blood pressure pills for 4 days because I'm in Gold Beach. I can't have them sent there. And I don't know when I'm going to be up here for sure. Now I do, but we got to pick them up today. And this happens routinely, that we're in the wrong place moving back and forth, and you can't get them to where you are. If you had them for 90 days, when if the doctor says, yeah, you're going to need them the rest of your life, it seems ridiculous that they're limiting us to a 30-day supply. In fact, I was going to do legislation, and I might yet. I'm going to decide this week.
I'll sign on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, that's not currently regulated. It is certainly something you may want to look at. I will say a number of insurance carriers have implemented programs where if you use a mail order pharmacy, for example, they authorize a 90-day supply rather than a 30-day supply because they want you to use a volume pharmacy with whom they've negotiated good discounts. It helps you and it helps them. So I don't know whether you've explored that option with your insurance carrier. There are some types of pharmaceuticals that are frequently prescribed for a or that an insurance company will authorize a prescription only for 30 days at a time because of a potential for abuse, for example, sleeping medications.
Yeah, I understand.
But by and large, many insurance companies do authorize for chronic conditions prescriptions for longer periods of time because it allows them to actually take advantage of volume discounts.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam, quick question.
Yes, thank you, Chair Holby. Corey, thanks for being here, Ken, and here we go for another session. Are you going to give us, you mentioned you'll be back the next meeting, are you going to give us a legislative agenda for your area and any comments on budget proposals for you guys?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam. Actually, our legislative agenda, we did give you just a very high-level summary in the packet.
Oh, sorry, I missed it.
I believe it's not in the packet. We will be by to drop one off almost right away.
Okay.
I will be talking about our mortgage lending proposals at the hearing on Monday.
Okay.
And we do have a budget proposal in the mortgage lending area as well.
Quick follow-up, if I can, Mr.
Follow-up,
Chair.
Please.
You know, you mentioned the economic downturn that we're all terribly, painfully aware of, and I noticed in the previous testimony, one of the problems, we want our consumers protected, obviously, but one of the sad results of this downturn is the need for increased staff. So I'm trying to get a feel for agencies, I think 8 in the Justice Department's case, and also I could look, I guess, in the governor's budget, but I haven't, how many extra employees you think you're going to need to cover the load.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I should have that number at my fingertips, but Mr. Tapman may be able to remind me in our mortgage lending budget package number of staff.
I could address that. We, Mr. Chair and Representative Gilliam, for the record, this is David Tapman speaking, and I'm with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is a division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And we put forward a policy option package, and we have identified three positions and then I believe four other positions. I may be wrong about that, and let me explain that to you. The three positions, you'll see there's a bill coming up soon that will address a national mortgage lending systems database in which we are going to start licensing all loan originators in Oregon through that system. It will take a fair amount of implementation in each state. So we're looking to have an IT specialist, information technology specialist, and two staff people address that. In addition, we're asking for additional staff to go out and expand our examination process. We've started that in the last 2 years. We've become much more full force about that. And we believe while we're off to a good start, we need to expand our individual examination modules, which will take more time, more staff. And what we're seeing is more of a national presence. So we have identified up to six additional positions, but that will depend in part on the size of the mortgage lending industry, and that is in flux right now. So it's kind of a touch-and-go situation, but that's what we've identified for the division. Otherwise, as you probably know, we had a couple additional positions added for our bank examination process because of the need for a more accelerated process there. Those are the only two that we're aware of in terms of what we're seeking right
possibly
now.
Eight, then.
Possibly seven.
Seven.
It could be. I'm sorry. We'll get you a hard, fast number.
That's fine.
Seven.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate the ways and means look at their agency as well. With any other questions, I really appreciate your comments, the insurance division being here as well, and
Mr. Chair, I'm disappointed that you didn't have any questions for Ms. Miller.
There'll be plenty of opportunities.
Well, I'm sure we can rectify that.
We'll be ready next
in the
time.
Very near future. But I appreciate you coming forward and your testimony today.
Thank
and
you.
Look forward to trying to handle some of these issues this session. With that, before I have the next group come up, I'm going to change things up just a little bit, unless Gail Shibley's got an important meeting to get to. I would like to go into work session at the moment and introduce a couple of bills that actually Corey had mentioned on the health insurance in their draft. And so with that, I'd like to open a work session for introduction of committee measures. And if I could get a motion, Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move that we accept these drafts into the committee as committee bills.
Representative Riley has moved LC 2305 and 2306 to be introduced by the House Committee on Consumer Protection. And with that, your support of this doesn't indicate, as you all probably know, that you are obligated to vote for the bill. This is just simply to get these bills drafted so this committee or some other might consider them for legislation. And with that, are there any objections to introducing these LCs? Seeing none, they are so adopted. And with that, I'd close the work session. And I believe Lee Beyer from the PUC had a meeting to get to, and I don't know if he's still out in the hall.
He was looking in the door, kind of checking to see our status a few minutes
ago.
Yeah,
I know he has a meeting that he has to travel to. And
She's got it.
Maybe we could hate to bump you, Gail, but
he passed a note.
Yeah, well, maybe he's not here, so you know, I don't know.
Maybe.
Here he is.
Oh, here he comes. I appreciate your patience, Ms. Shibley.
My apologies, Mr. Chair.
Well, I got your note that you had a previous engagement that you needed to get to, so I wanted to make sure I wasn't the cause of the commissioner being late.
Mr. Chair, I would never put anything before the legislature. As they say, I know who signs the check. Mr. Chair, for the record, I am Lee Beyer, Chair of the Public Utility Commission, and here at your request today to talk about how we do consumer affairs stuff. Got a little handout for you. I guess I would start off by saying that from our perspective, our basic role is we are a consumer protection agency. That's why we exist. The way we're paid, I say that the customers, utility customers, and I should say of private utilities, on their bill pay a little over 15 cents a month to provide the PUC, and we work for them. That's the perspective we take on there. Now, there's some balancing that we do about that, but that we have to make sure that the utilities are whole and can perform their duties. But that's kind of where we come. And essentially, our mission statement is to ensure that safe and reliable utility services are provided to consumers at just and reasonable rates, legal term. Most people think of that as fair. And through regulation, the promotion and development of competitive markets. So it's a little dual charge in terms of the competitive markets. That one of the things, particularly in the telephone area, that the legislature, Oregon legislature, as well as Congress has said, is we're supposed to try to promote that competition among telephone providers, less so on the others. So who do we do this for and what? We're essentially dealing with the four utility areas: electricity, gas, telephone and water, and those are they're fundamental utilities, if you think about it, that really are the bedrock of our existence. You know, you kind of want those things. You get up, you turn the light switch on, and it has to be there. If you're operating, manufacturing, you're using gas or natural gas to produce your products. So it kind of is the enabler to make a lot of things happen. Each of these companies are major businesses in Oregon, employ a lot of people, and affect most everybody in the state. The issues for consumers are really, and the industry, is that they want their utilities to provide reliable, high quality of services at a cost that are fair and competitive. And the main reason we're into this, and again I'll stress that we're only dealing with private companies, is that in most all cases you're talking about the state has determined policy that you'd have a monopoly, so we're there to service the buffer between that and make sure that that price is fair. Specifically, what we do in terms of consumer protection is the commission sets consumer rates, and we do this through a quasi-judicial process that allows a lot of intervention by anybody who chooses to. You know, anybody can participate, but realistically what we're talking about is you have the utility and you have formal intervener groups such as the Citizens Utility Board, which has a state legislative sanction to represent residential customers, and various business groups such as the Industrial Gas the Industrial Gas Providers Association, or the Industrial Customers, so we call ICNU, on the electrical side, that are there, and they aggressively, along with our staff, which we don't talk to. The process is such as once we set a case in front of us, we set, as you would expect a court to do, we set on the other side, and they intervene and argue very strenuously and look over all of the materials, and at the end of the day, the balancing is that you come out with what's a fair cost. And I would say again that utilities under private rights have the right to recover their prudent cost, and on top of that, the prudent cost, they're allowed to, their shareholders are entitled to a fair return on their investment in equity, and that's kind of the balance that we do in terms of that. So we do that rates. We also look over the quality of services to make sure that people are getting what they pay for in a quality manner. And then, of course, we handle individual consumer complaints. Some of the kinds of queries that we get from people, and I would say that we get a call in our small little call center from an Oregonian about every 6 minutes. And answer the question. So there's a lot that goes on with that. Some of it in things like slamming and cramming on telephone bills, questions or complaints about service quality problems, billing disputes, poor customer service, disconnections, safety violation, and the rate protests, those tend to come up, obviously, when we're doing a rate case and it hits the newspapers, we hear about it all the time. The following chart gives you just an example of the volume of calls, contacts that we have. And when I say calls, I'm including that emails. We get considerably more. As you have been getting more emails from your constituents, we get the same kind of contacts down. We have a very good website that helps people deal with that. So as Oregon has grown, the questions and the concerns keep going up, too. So it's just the nature of the business. My industry, about 48% of our customer contacts relate to telecommunications. About 9% of them are wireless. 19% are electric, 12% natural gas, 5% water, and 7% other. Other would include such things as general safety concerns that may span a lot of things, or things like broadband connections, that which we don't have direct regulatory authority over. And I would note, even on, like, for telephone, we do not have direct authority over wireless, although we do deal with it through an agreement with the Department of Justice. They have, you probably heard earlier, they have entered into a voluntary compliance agreement with most of the cellular providers, under which we have entered into a memorandum of agreement where we will handle the customer complaints. And I think the difference, they probably told you, their statute that they're working under deals with trade practices, unfair trade practices, which deal with trying to get a case, you know, where there's a business that's not compliant. Our orientation is a little different. Our orientation is the customer calls, has a problem. We try to resolve that problem as quickly as we can for the customer's favor. So that's where we're interested in. And it's the smaller stuff. You know, a lot of the calls that we'll get, maybe over a $2 billing dispute or something like that, maybe more than that. And it's just not the kind of thing that you really want to see go to court. Frankly, when we call the utilities, understandably, we get a little more responsive addressing the point than perhaps the customer does directly. Although I would like to emphasize that our first response to a customer, and the first question is, have you contacted the utility and talked to them about this? And if they haven't, we say, here's the person you need to contact, to the number. Why don't you contact them, see if you can resolve it, and if you can't, then give us a call. The nature of having these kinds of discussions suggests that there are lots of problems, and I don't want to suggest that. I think our utilities do a very good job in Oregon for the most part, and we're really dealing with the exceptions and misunderstandings. And in this business, there's a lot of misunderstandings. I would say that a good share of the complaints we get are frankly not justified, but the customer feels better. They feel that their state government is responsive when we address it, and if they're not understanding it correctly, having them explain that to them, they go away saying they may not like it, but they feel better about it. And I think that's important, trust in government. So I've kind of covered the last piece, which is the DOJ thing. Just to be real clear with you on the telephone side, because a lot of questions come up around that, there's the industry obviously has changed a lot over the time. Most of the Oregon laws were written back when Ma Bell was one company, and it's not like that anymore. And we've got we have issues like voice over the internet protocol. You'll hear that terminology, internet-based phone services, as well as the wireline. So there's some disputes on that, and frankly, federal law is not completely clear on that. The definitions have not caught up with the technology as much. So we're kind of working through that on a national as well as a state base. Same is true with cellular. While that seems like old technology now, the split is still, it's much more of a national rather than a state-by-state thing, so there's differences there in how we deal with that. And I think some of that's changing. One of the things that we have been working on through our national association is to promote the idea for wireless, for example, of having a national standard of trade practices, much as we have with slamming and cramming issues on telephones, with state. The states then could opt into handling consumer complaints with that. That approach would deal with the company's legitimate concerns of saying we have to have a standardized rules that we can provide our services or sell our service, market our services nationally, yet still be responsive to customer concerns rather than having people try to figure out who they're supposed to call at a national level. You know, you talk to your constituents and say, well, have you ever talked or thought about calling the FCC, and it's kind of like, who? And So it's that kind of a thing that most people don't know to call the PUC, but at least, you know, we're a little closer than the federal government is. So, Mr. Chair, that's a very quick over-the-top, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Appreciate the over-the-top. And quick, I have one question. When you mentioned that telecommunications, I'm just kind of curious, the definition of telecommunications, does that include TV, cable, and, you know, other types of just internet providers and things like that? You sort of touched on that. I'm just kind of curious where the PUC or the industry is at with regulation in those arenas.
I could have a lot of different responses to that, Mr. Chairman. Please don't go there. No, actually, telecommunications, the definition is you're basically talking about the old basic telephone service, wired service to the house. As I think you're probing there, obviously there are people who are buying what they consider to be the telephone service from cable companies now. There are people that are buying them from over the Internet from other kinds of companies that that come over their broadband connection, whatever that is, if it's through the telephone, a telephone company under what's called DSL, or through the cable side on that side. So there's various flavors out there, and right now the law is such that that is not defined as something the states can get into. You're actually, as a legislature, probably precluded from dealing with that directly. Similarly, with cellular, there's limits on what you can do. The law, the federal law, says you can deal as a state. You can choose to deal with terms and conditions, but there's been a lot of litigation over what does that mean. So it's an evolving law right now, but I would say that you don't have it. Now, let me step away from that. And same is true with franchising of cable systems. We don't do that in Oregon. Right now, local governments do franchising of systems. Some states have chosen to move franchising to the state level. I would certainly not advocate that. Having served as the chairman of a local cable commission board, I really think it's a good idea to leave it at the local level. But that's more of a, I don't want to deal
but
with
you can't help me with, you cannot help me with my cable bill then for my cable TV.
Mr. Chairman, what I would tell you is that if you called up and said, I have this problem, we would try to help you.
Oh, okay.
And we do that now with issues around broadband. We certainly do that on cellular issues. We try to help the citizens out, although we try to be very clear with them, the limits of our authority, but we understand the issues and sometimes can usually know the right person to call. Television stuff is a little, the cable TV is a little different because you're dealing with individual boards, although we know most, my staff knows most of those people and can direct them to the right place.
Thank you. Any other questions for
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cowan.
Just my ignorance, probably, but could you tell me what slamming and cramming means?
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan,
it refers to my cable
We've
bill.
We've talked about that so long.
I'm sorry, I'm new to this.
Slamming is a term of art in the telecommunications business, and it refers to long-distance providers where you used to be able, you still can, buy a long-distance service from a provider separate than your existing one. Slamming would be where somebody, a company, came in without your permission and changed your designation from who you had as a long-distance provider to their service. And there's a lot of different ways to do that, but that's becoming less of an issue because a lot of people are using their cell phones for that. Cramming refers to the local phone company where you get your bill and you say, I don't understand what all these things are. You may be paying for three-way calling and caller ID and voicemail and a lot of things you don't believe you agreed to buy and all of a sudden appear on your bill.
Okay.
And they're usually small little things that people don't notice right away. But they make a lot of difference when you multiply it by thousands of people.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kamei.
Thank you. If I may address two issues.
Sure.
One of the things I hear from my constituents are complaints about cable TV and people who've had cable TV for years and then the they're charged more and more, and some of the stations or channels that they really like are taken off. So that's one of the concerns. The other is wireless telephone service, cell phone service. And especially if kids have access to the cell phones, that they can put $1,000 worth of charges in just, you know, a very, very short time and feel like they don't have much recourse. So I'm hearing you say that that's not really an issue, that PUC deals with those two issues.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, we don't deal with the television issues, and I will tell you that from my knowledge about it, there's limits to what a local cable commission can regulate there,
right,
as well. And
right,
it's what they call basic service, and they define that the stations beyond that are really the company can package it any way they wish to and sell. There's no direct regulation over that. If billing complaints, they will deal with those, but there's limits on what they can do. From the PUCs, we have no authority over that. And the best we're going to do is get to them and maybe help the customer understand the questions they might ask and who to call to. Sometimes we can go a little farther than that, but we have no direct authority. The cellular is really, cellular service is really a contracted service. You buy a package, and what you'll usually hear from them, from the company who bought it, you know, it's the teenager doing too much and said, well, you bought 200 minutes. You used 500. Contract says anything over 200 mm-hmm. minutes is 5 cents a minute or mm-hmm. whatever. I mean, that's a pretty straight-up contract issue. Sometimes we can help resolve some of that. Sometimes the companies will credit it back on sort of a one-time basis. Okay, you didn't understand it. We'll deal with it. But there's no guarantees, and it's basically what kind of a good faith deal can be worked out with the company. We have no authority to fix that. We try our best to help the customer out, and we have pretty good luck with it. And I will say that most of the cellular companies are pretty good at working with us on those issues. And again, the fact of the matter is, when we deal with it, we tend to get a different initial response from the company than a customer did mm-hmm. first time through.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, 4:30.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Appreciate you coming forward and giving us your quick overview, and probably be talking to you in the future.
Thank you much.
Thank you. And with that, I'd like to call up Gail Shibley, who's been waiting patiently in the Department of Human Services. And here you go.
Mr. Chair, you don't have to leave.
I'll be right back.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee. It's a delight and pleasure to be here. For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. And you know you work for government when your title wraps around your business card a time or two, I suppose. DHS's mission is to help make sure that people can be independent, healthy, and safe. Public Health Division's mission is to promote and protect the health of the people of Oregon. And my office in environmental public health is really about preventing unhealthy exposures from the environment that impact human health. We do that in several different ways. A lot of the time, it's frankly providing people the information they need to keep themselves and their families safe. But it is also education, it is technical assistance, training at times, research studies, analysis of data, regulations, including setting standards, certifying and accrediting, licensing individuals and firms, and it's really all about prevention. We take a look at toxics or environmental contamination. We look for completed exposure pathways. There's a little term of art, so to speak, and then we look at the population that may be affected, recognizing, of course, that we are not all as EPA studies are based upon 70 kilogram adult males. There are additional sensitivities, whether it's pregnant women or fetuses, children.
the elderly, people with compromised immune systems, and on and on and on. To do our my office is organized in four different sections. The first focuses on what is probably the number one consumer product anywhere in the country, not just here in Oregon, drinking water. Last I checked, most of us drink water, and in some form or another. And a big chunk of my office is helping make sure that every time you turn on the tap, you can rely on it being safe to drink. That is a federal and state regulatory oversight program. Radiation Protection Services is a second piece, and as I used to say, everything from Trojan to tanning beds, and everything in between. Every source of ionizing and non-ionizing radiation, whatever its circumstance, it may be a medical X-ray machine, or it could be a soils testing device that contains a radioactive source. Doesn't matter if it's radiation, we care about it because of that environmental concern, because of the public health concern of that environmental exposure. Food, pool, and lodging. That is making sure that when you go out to your favorite restaurant, the food is handled in a safe way and is stored and provided in a safe way so that it's good food and doesn't make you sick. Pools, likewise, all the community pools throughout the state, whether it's literally the pool that's right across the street here that's temporarily closed down to YMCA or a hotel motel kind of pool. Lodging, everything from hotels and motels, organizational camps, summer camps, RV parks, all of those you will see a little thing on the back of the door in many cases that indicate some of the oversight that part of the lodging industry is overseen by us. Our toxicology assessment and tracking section really provides an awful lot of very small one of programs that I'll mention here in just 2 minutes. But it also provides a very important scientific basis for a lot of the work that we do, not just within my office, but other parts of the public health division as well. All told, depending on how you kind of slice and dice it, there are about 36, 38 programs in my office within these four sections, about $44 million of biennium. About 10% is state general fund, which is used as partial state match for the federal dollars that we get from the U.S. EPA for safe drinking water oversight. All of the rest is either fee-for-service or federal grant dollars. So, as I mentioned before, in doing our work, we work an awful lot with DEQ. In fact, some people have said, you know, DEQ's mission is to protect the environment from people. And if that's true, then perhaps my mission is the complement of that, which is to protect the people from the environment. But the two certainly have to work together, and we do in many, many areas. Also, Director Streisinger's department, whether it's OR/OSHA or building codes or others, we work with very closely Department of Agriculture on pesticides-related issues in particular, as well as food safety. And water quality, since about 90% of the water in the state is under the control, really, of agriculture, not drinking water. And certainly with the federal government, we work with, you know, the alphabet soup of federal agencies, both as funders as well as partners and collaborators in a variety of ways. There's some things that we do really well, and when I say we, I'm talking about the public health system, which is is, certainly as Representative Cohen and many of you know, is inextricably linked at the state and the local levels. We work hand in glove with our partners at the local health departments to do the job overall. So I don't mean to project that it is solely me and my office and the employees at the state level. We are in every county in the state working hard on a variety of these issues. But the things that we do well tend to be those things that we have been doing for some time, and appropriately were prioritized, which is acute and communicable diseases. We want to make sure that if there's a waterborne outbreak, we're on top of it. That can spread very quickly. You've heard some of the terrible tragedies of cholera outbreaks, for example, in I believe it's Uganda recently, and we know what happens when there's a foodborne outbreak, foodborne illnesses, very important to get on top of and respond to immediately. Likewise, the Safe Drinking Water Act, we actually have 91 contaminants that we screen for. But they tend to be reportable exposures. They tend to be the acute effects. Very important, don't get me wrong, but there's a reason I'm making that distinction, and that is that it is the chronic subacute exposures that historically, as a public health system, we have not had, frankly, the time or other resources, including dollars and expertise and science, to really understand and to do the very best job at. And specifically, the reason I raise that is that, when I mentioned before, we care about what is the contaminant, and the completed exposure pathway, and then the population at the receiving end, so to speak. Historically, what people have looked at is the dose makes the poison, or the solution to pollution is dilution. Maybe some of you have heard that. That's true. Asterisk, because concentration is important and duration of contact and exposure is important. The frequency of that exposure is important. But it's not only that. It is the timing of that exposure. And that's why, for example, if you expose developing fetuses to endocrine disruptors at certain stages of development, you have different kinds of acute effects, more marked effects than you would a 70 kilogram adult male, for example. And so as the scientific literature is catching up with a lot of the more anecdotal or apocryphal concerns that I know you and I and many people have voiced some concern about, or rather heard some concern about, we need to make sure as a public health system that we're not just focused on the acute and communicable diseases, but also understand that cancers, endocrine disruptors, hormonal imbalances, what's called precocious puberty, other kinds of significant human health effects are also on our radar screen. And consequently, we are, with the legislature's support, very strategically but very energetically seeking additional funding at the federal level for certain pieces to kind of add to our ability in terms of expertise and understanding and other resources. We're fortunate to have some great interns that we have and CDC fellows who are providing us additional support. We do have a couple legislative proposals One is that I think we'll be coming to perhaps Representative Tomei's committee, House Bill 2134, that increases our lead-based paint oversight by adopting a new federal program. The EPA fairly recently, just earlier in 2008, expanded its regulation of the kinds of activities involving lead-based paint, and it's one of those you can either do it state and adopt this these standards in this program or something more strict, or we're going to do it. So not too surprisingly, Oregon and most every other state is saying, it's okay, we'll do it here at the state level. So so we have a bill that we look forward to talking to you about around that issue. Also, House Bill 2141, which I believe this committee may be having an opportunity to take a look at, updates the definition of hazardous substance, which is in ORS 453005. That is part of our current statutory authority. Hazardous substance is actually defined in about seven different dimensions, but it's really focused on, again, the acute effects of exposure to a hazardous substance. And part of what I referred to earlier in terms of these chronic subacute exposures is being able to make sure that the definition of hazardous substance reflects the 21st century scientific literature. This statute has been on the books, and we've had this authority since, I think, 1971, when the Federal Hazardous Substances Act passed, and we periodically have used it historically, not very often, but we think this is an important update to that longstanding law. And thirdly, from the Senate side, and I don't have a bill number because I don't know that it's yet been dropped. It is not an agency bill, but Senator Dingfelder, I believe, will be introducing a bill with our support and effort to expand the information that buyers of property with private wells can have current statute now requires that sellers of property with private domestic wells have their wells tested for nitrates and total coliforms. We would like to add arsenic to that list because we know that arsenic is a problem in many parts of the state. It's naturally occurring. It's not like somebody's out there polluting our wells particularly. But we know that it's a considerable public health concern, and we know that it's out there. And just as importantly, in terms of this bill, the current law requires that the seller provide DHS the results of those tests. We want to actually expand that so that the buyer of the property gets those test results as well. And that, Mr. Chair, members, circles back around to, as I started out by saying, a lot of what we do is simply providing people the information that they need so they can make thoughtful, informed decisions about how to keep themselves and their families safe. So with that, I'm happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Don't see any. Ms. Shibley, I thank you very much for coming forward. I don't know that you've been in front of this particular committee before, but I know that our subject matters sometimes overlap with other committees concerning health and concerning water and whatnot. But certainly I've recognized that your particular agency, though not very well known, does play in a very important part with the consumers and making sure that products are safe. So with that, you know, that's my interest in having your agency here and participating in this committee, this session, because I believe we will have some legislative proposals that will involve those products and their safety. So I appreciate you being here and giving us a little overview of your agency, because it sounds like your agency deals with a lot of different people. And I guess a question I have is,
with food products, for example. You know, they fall under the purview of the Department of Agriculture. For instance, we now have this peanut butter scare right now. So who in the state of Oregon is dealing with that?
Mr. Chair, first of all, thank you for your leadership on behalf of protecting consumers, and you're absolutely right. It is, consumer protection really is public health protection, and a quick look at ORS 458 will indicate just some of the connection that my office and my division, my department has specific to that point. In terms of food, I'll pick a number, 96% of food safety is directly under the jurisdiction of the Department of Agriculture. Public health particular focus is on food ready to eat, quote unquote, as a term of art, which is food service facilities, i.e., restaurants of various types. But the actual initial product and the warehousing, grocery stores, etc., all of that is Department of Agriculture. That said, our Cracker Jack epidemiologists at State Public Health typically are very involved and directly involved with our colleagues at Department of Agriculture, and I believe that that's exactly the case with this latest peanut butter issue as well.
Thank you. Representative?
You asked the question I was going to ask. Thank you.
Oh, okay. You were interested in your peanut butter, too?
I am very interested in peanut butter.
Okay. Well, are there any other questions? I appreciate you coming forward and giving us this overview from your department. It's very
helpful.
Glad
to save the best for last.
Very helpful for me to understand all the different agencies we have looking out for consumers out there, and I appreciate your department as well. Committee, that concludes our overview, informational meeting of different agency programs, and as mentioned, this is not an inclusive list, as we just learned the Department of Agriculture also regulates products as well, which may be something you may want to talk about in the future. And just one little quick note, I know that some of you have contacted me about not being available for a particular committee meeting, and I really appreciate being notified that you may be gone or not, but unless you hear from me, you're perfectly excused. I don't have any way to compel you to come. Well, maybe I do, I don't know, but it's not my intention to do that. So you can just assume that you're excused unless I contact you and say, no, you absolutely have to be here. Because I know there was a misunderstanding earlier about someone who wanted to inform me that wanted to be excused, and I didn't formally get back and excuse them. So just for FYI, you can, as the committee rules, unless we notify you that you're not excused, you can assume you are, as long as you let me know ahead of time that you're not going to be here. That would be great. Any other issues? Comments or Representative Tomei?
So our next meeting is Monday?
Our next meeting is Monday, and I got your note.
Thank you.
So we will be reviewing mortgage lending and some of the foreclosure issues that this committee dealt with last session, and kind of an overview of where we are today. And we will also be having a public hearing on two bills that are coming forward from the Department of Consumer Business Services, House Bill 2188 and House Bill 2189. Victoria, is that correct?
That's correct, but we are meeting Friday as well. Our next meeting.
Oh, that was Monday.
Sorry about that.
Friday we are having a meeting. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
I wondered if I missed something. I'm running through my agenda. I was trying to slip that
you
in.
You guys aren't confused, are you?
You almost didn't have a committee.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Friday off.
Now, Friday we are having an overview of the recalled children products bill that we passed last session, House Bill 3631 from last session, with a report from the Department of Justice on that, and we will be having a public hearing on House Bill 2365, which is the prohibition of selling
the novelty lighters, essentially. And that will be the overview for Friday. I don't expect that hearing to be until 5 o'clock, so it will get done sooner than that.
Until 5 o'clock, or will be done by 5 o'clock?
It will be done before 5 o'clock. I'm hoping 4:30 at the latest. But I oftentimes can't predict how long people talk, including myself. So, with that, I appreciate you being here and hanging in through this riveting overview of agencies.
Go ahead.
And I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.